This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeff Moldauer, has had a lifelong passion for jazz and blues of the 20s and 30s. His recordings reinterpreting that music are not only enjoyable in their own right, they've led many listeners to seek out recordings from that era. Moldauer was a founding member of the Jim Queskin Jug Band in 1962. The band was together for about 6 years and inspired people like Jerry Garcia and John Sebastian. After the Jug Band broke up, Moldauer recorded with his then-wife, Maria Moldauer, and teamed up with Paul Butterfield to form the band Better Days. In the mid-80s, he began a long sabbatical from performing, re-emerging in 1999 with the album The Secret Handshake. Now he has a new CD called Texas Sheiks that features his old friend Jim Queskin as a guest star. He's brought his guitar and will perform for us later, but let's start with the opening track from his new CD. This is The World Is Going Wrong, featuring Moldauer on vocal and six-string banjo.
Strange things are happening like never before. My baby told me I would have to go. I can't be good no more, once like I did before. I can't be good, baby, honey, because the world's gone wrong. Feel bad this morning. Cause the world's gone wrong. Can't be good no more, like I did before. Can't be good, baby, honey, because the world's gone wrong. I try to be loving.
That's Jeff Moldauer and the Texas Sheiks from the new album Texas Sheiks. Jeff Moldauer, welcome to Fresh Air. I love the CD. There's a nice story behind this album. Well, nice is the wrong word because it's about a good friend of yours who was sick. But tell us the story behind it.
Well, first of all, it's good to be here. And you're talking about Stephen Bruton.
Yeah.
My longtime friend from Fort Worth, Texas, and eventually Austin, Texas. And I met Stephen in Newport, Rhode Island when the Jug Band was playing there. He drove up there when he was a teenager in a jacket and tie to see our banjo player, Bill Keith, because at the time he was a banjo player. And, we played over the years in various situations, recordings, and some road work together, but he was mostly the backup guy for Kris Kristofferson and Bonnie Raitt and others. And it's tough to talk about him still, you know, because he passed away this last May. And we put this album together so he could just have some fun and forget about what was going on with all his treatments down in Austin. So we got his friends together and we made the Texas Sheiks album.
So he died before it was released.
But he got to hear it on
good.
Those beautiful earphones he had, and he was smiling.
Good.
You know, so.
I'm always interested in hearing how people discover music that isn't the music being played or listened to by their generation. How did you discover early jazz and blues?
Well, I'm a kid of the 50s. And actually, it started a little earlier than that for me because my brother had this record collection of 78s and LPs of jazz people. So I used to spend all my time in his room after school and listening to Bessie Smith and Louis Armstrong and Big Spider Beck and all these great jazz players. And in amongst that stuff were little smatterings of country blues. You know, they'd put them on an anthology or something. All of a sudden there'd be a Lead Belly piece or a Blind Lemon Jefferson piece or a Blind Willie Johnson piece. And they'd go, what is that stuff? You know, it was very mysterious to me, the country blues thing. And at that time in America, there wasn't a huge difference in the feeling of things between what I was hearing on the street corner with doo-wop music and, you know, which was so gospel-related, and the pop music at the time. I'm out, you know, as a 13-year-old kid buying Fats Domino and Little Richard. And Jimmy Reed, you know, we're living outside of New York and we're dancing to Jimmy Reed. So times were very different, and there were influences coming from all over.
Well, you've been generous enough to bring your guitar with you. I'd like you to play one of the first early jazz or blues songs that you fell in love with that made you really want to seek out more music from that period.
Well, I couldn't help but fall in love with Lonnie Johnson. I mean, he was on some of those jazz records with Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington. And then my friend Joe Boyd and his brother Warwick and myself went down to Philadelphia, picked him up and brought him up to a party when we were living in Princeton, New Jersey.
Well, let's back up a second. What was he doing in Philadelphia? Wasn't he working at a hotel or something?
Yeah, he was. I thought he was washing dishes. Other people said he might have been a cook or something. But he came out of that door with a suit on and his big guitar case, and we took him up to the home of Murray Kempton, who was a journalist, and passed the hat for him. And, you know, we just kept screaming for these blues things, including this tune I'll play a little bit for you called Jelly Roll Baker. She said, Mr. Jelly Roll Baker, let me be your slave. Gabriel blows his trumpet, then I'll rise from my grave for some of your sweet jelly roll. Yes, I love your sweet jelly roll. It's good for the sick, yes, and it's good for the old. I was in a hospital, all shot full of holes. Nurse left a man dying just to get her jelly roll. She loved her jelly. Yeah, she loved her sweet jelly roll. She'd rather leave a man dying than to miss her sweet jelly roll.
Oh, that's great. So when you were listening to that as a kid... Did you know jelly roll, what was intended by the word jelly roll?
That's a good question, because I was saying things around the house I was getting in trouble for, and I didn't know, I mean, I hit this stuff so young.
Right.
And especially the Bessie Smith stuff. So, yeah, I knew by then, and that's one of the tunes we were asking for at that party. And, you know, double entendre, you know, when you're young.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Moldauer, and he has a new CD called Texas Sheiks. And we're talking about how he first discovered early blues and jazz. You did an album in about 2003 of songs that Bix Beiderbecke played on or that were from his period. So these are songs from the late 20s and 30s. And in the liner notes, to this, you write, in my house, in my father's world of rah-rah Ivy League grads, Bix lore was common fare. Everyone seemed to have a Bix story about meeting him, drinking with him. And later you write that the trumpeter Muggsy Spanier came to your house and spent time in your brother's room listening to music. How did your family know these people?
Well, my brother was out there doing reconnaissance. He was 10 years older than I was. So when he was 18, going into... 52nd Street and down to the village, I was 8. So when he was hunting up these people, and my parents loved Dixieland and that kind of music anyway, so they'd go down there to Nick's or to Ryan's and these clubs in New York. And, they, you know, when everybody starts having those cocktails and having fun, you meet people. So somehow Muggsy Spanier came out to the house, and that was impressive.
Were you there? You were there?
Oh, I was sitting there listening to him. I remember him talking about kicking his mute around the room to get individual types of bumps in it so his sound would be different than anybody else's.
Oh, that's almost avant-garde.
Well, there you go. That's typical of avant-garde, you know. Keep going back with it. But and he also talked about Bix, and I remember that, just sort of shaking his head, you know, sadly.
Your Big Spiderbeck record is so much fun. I think we should hear a track from it. And this is you singing lead on Take Your Tomorrow and Give Me Today. Do you want to say anything about why you chose to put this on the CD and how you arranged it?
Well, the original reason for the CD was to do the chamber arrangements of the piano pieces. So they're all on
there. Of the Beiderbecke piano pieces.
Yes, yes. And, you know, we wanted to spice it up with some of the old tunes, and we decided to do them in ways that have never been done. In other words, if a male sang the original, then a female could sing this time. Or if it was a group effort, it would be a single solo effort. So I tried to mix it up per usual. I don't like to try and recreate the sounds of others. I try and sort of get an impression. I guess I'm sort of an impressionist.
Okay, so this is Jeff Meldauer from his album from about 2003 that's a tribute to Big Spiderbeck.
Why should I wait for happiness? I've grown impatient more or less. I cannot wait somehow. Show me a bluebird now.
Take your tomorrow and give me today. For your tomorrow is too far away.
That's Jeff Meldauer from his album Private Astronomy, A Vision of the Music of Big Spiderbeck. Jeff Meldauer has a new CD called Texas Sheiks. That's really so much fun to listen to. One of my favorite quotes about you comes from Loudon Wainwright, who said, "Jeff Meldauer was and is one of my musical heroes. When I listen to him sing and play, I can hear the coal mine, the cotton field, last, but certainly foremost, the boys' boarding school."
He is such a clever guy.
Isn't he? So when you were listening to blues, you know, when you were young, did you feel a connection to the world of the blues singers? Or did you feel like you lived in this very distant world, distant in time and place and class?
Well, there's a good question. You know, I didn't feel comfortable in the world that I knew around me.
Why not?
It wasn't the best of childhoods for me. But music was an escape. I don't know that I identified with the world of the musicians that I was listening to, but I identified with some mysterious spirituality that was in there, some feeling. And this is not uncommon. You know, how come a flute player from South Side of Chicago named Paul Butterfield picked up the harmonica and became one of the greatest blues harmonica players of all time? So you just don't know who's going to get hit with this kind of feeling or ability. And I'm very grateful I was hit with a little of it.
You wrote a song about looking for Blind Lemon Jefferson's grave. Blind Lemon Jefferson was one of the great blues performers. So the song is about wanting to find his grave so you could make sure it was clean. You actually did this. The song is based on an actual trip that you made. What inspired you to do it?
Probably alcohol. I was up all night in New Orleans as usual. I was living down there when I was 18.
Uh-huh.
And hanging out at these crazy places with these crazy people. You know, it was 1961, and things were swinging. And so we were down over at, you know, near the Café Du Monde, a little south of there, having some red beans and rice, and I thought about this tune, One Kind Favor I'll Ask of You, Please See That My Grave Is Kept Clean.
That's one of his songs.
And I goaded these four guys that were with me into cruising around the streets to look for brooms, and we found them, and by the time the sun was up and, you know, in the morning, we were hitchhiking to East Texas through the bayou country. You know, this is not a recommended trip for anybody. So I'm here to tell the tale. The first trip ended up in a turnaround, which I wrote about in the song, spending the night in jail in Lafayette. But I got there eventually.
And did you sweep the grave?
Of course. They had moved it by the time I got there. But it is a beautiful little graveyard. You know, we found one big graveyard, and we're standing, and it was all these people with sort of coiffed hair and white belts, and it just didn't feel right. I said, Blind Lemon could not be in this graveyard, and I looked across this field, sort of a floodplain, and there was this little island of dirt that with little trees on it, and then it, you know, and grass, and little split rail fence with these scissor tail flycatchers going up and down off of the fence. And I looked over there, I said, he's there, he's got to be there. And we ran across that field and found him and found his mother and his sister. It was beautiful.
Who moved his grave?
Some blues society.
Good.
So as you can tell from this, it took a few years before I got back there, but I got back there.
Well, would you perform some of your song about Blind Lemon Jefferson, about looking for the grave?
Why, certainly.
Thank you.
Let's see if I can remember this one. With my broom in my hand, headed out from Jackson Square. With my broom in my hand, headed out from Jackson Square. I had to get to East Texas, find that graveyard somewhere. Well, down on Highway 90, not fell on Lafayette. Well, down on Highway 90, not fell on Lafayette. I had one dime in my pocket. I was hungry and I was soaking wet. So it goes on like that.
It's a nice song. It's called Got to Find Blind Lemon Jefferson Part 1, and it's on Jeff Muldaur's album, The Secret Handshake, and he's performing for us today in the studio. He has a new CD called Texas Sheiks. So how did you get put in prison, which we hear about a little later in the song?
No. Just jail, just for the night.
Jail, right. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes. And that happened how?
Well, I'll tell you how it happened. I was so cold. It was in the high 20s, and I had moccasins on and a Martin guitar with me. And I went into a little cop shop on the outside of town, and I asked him if I could stay there. This is going to be a little hard to believe, but this is what happened. And they said, well, you got to get out of here. You can't stay here. And I said, look, if I were to run at you, you would then tackle me and arrest me, right? And then you could take me to jail. And they said, this guy's so crazy, let's take him downtown. And they took me downtown and let me sleep up there for the night.
So you really asked there for, like, you know, room for a night.
Yeah. So that's why I even, in the lyric, write it that way. Somebody said, don't write it that way. I said, hey, that's what happened. I asked to get in jail.
You just do those two lines for us.
Well, let me see. Please, Mr. Policeman, please put me in your jail. Well, please, Mr. Policeman, please put me in your jail. I got to get me some rest before I get back on the trail. Cause I got to find Blind Lemon. Gotta find Blind Lemon. I got to find Blind Lemon. See that his grave is kept clean.
So you met Jim Queskin, and with him formed the Jim Queskin Jug Band. And obviously you found somebody in him who was a musical kindred spirit. I mean, he's even on the new CD, on the Texas Sheiks CD.
He sure is.
Performing Blues in the Bottle, which is one of the songs he was famous for with the Jug Band. Why a jug band with literally a jug?
Well, I think his friend who called himself Bruno Wolf thought about the jug. And, you know, we got Fritz Richmond to pick up the jug and try it out, and he was so quick to make it fun that it sort of, you know, and we used the jug on certain tunes, but he also played washtub bass, and he had a great bass head, and he was a great part singer. And we just used the whole jug band idea as a sort of you know, a loose and groovy kind of thing. And it was just an excuse to do anything we wanted, you know. Sort of like when Terry Gilliam did the Brazil thing, it became an image of some mystical place. It bears no real connection, you know. So this whole idea of a jug band, and I guess you may know that, I mean, all the folk groups then wore striped shirts and had stage patter, and it was very commercial in those days. And so the jug band was sort of a precursor of the Grateful Dead, you know, but acoustic.
Would you like to play a song that you did in the jug band period?
Oh, yeah. Let me see here. This is one of the first things I ever did with the jug band, with Jim Queskin Jug Band. It's called Wild About My Lovin'. Listen here, people, about to sing this song. Gone to St. Louis, and it won't be long. Wild about my loving, I like to have my fun. You wanna be a girl of mine, baby, bring it with you when you come. Don't need no sugar in my tea, cause the girl I love, sweet enough for me. Wild about my loving, I like to have my fun. You wanna be a girl of mine, baby, bring it with you when you come.
This is Jeff Moldauer performing in the studio, and he has a new CD called Texas Sheiks. It must have been amazing performing with the jug band in the 60s at a time when probably, like, a lot of the people in the audience were really high, and probably some of the people on stage were too. There was this sense of kind of community at that time, I think it's fair to say, between performers and audiences that was based in part on liking this music that other people didn't like or didn't know about, and also about sharing in this alternative culture. So can you talk a little bit what it was like for you being a performer in that period?
Well, you know, there were different sets of circumstances. The one you just mentioned was the most common, but we became sort of a curiosity piece for television. So we were on a lot of television shows. We'd come out to L.A. We'd do the Johnny Carson show. We did the Steve Allen show. We did three of those. And we'd do all the, you know, whoever was having a weekly variety show like Pat Boone or
really?
Al Hurt. Oh, yeah. And so we were sort of a curiosity. And we sure weren't playing for our compadres in those audiences. And it was really interesting. They love those good old chunky, you know, funky things. You know, you'd get this square audience in a studio in Burbank, and they were just loving it.
Why don't we hear what the band actually sounded like together? Is there a track that you'd particularly like to hear?
Well, Jimmy and I have been playing recently, and Blues My Naughty Sweetie might be a good one.
Oh, that's perfect. Okay, let's hear that. And that's the opening track from, I think the album's just called Drug Band Music.
You got it.
So let's hear this. This is Jeff Moldauer with the Jim Queskin Drug Band.
There are blues that you get from loneliness, and there are blues that you get from pain, and there are blues when you are lonely, for you're one and only. The blues you can never explain, and there are blues that you get from sleepless nights. Whoa, but the meaning blues that be, they're the blues that I've got on my mind. I mean the ones that are the meanest kind. They're the blues my naughty sweetie gives to me. Let's hear it now.
This is the Jim Queskin Jug Band with my guest, Jeff Moldauer. And Jeff Moldauer is a singer, guitarist, and arranger. And his new CD is called Texas Sheiks. How did the band split up?
Well, Jim had been joining a sort of a communal situation on Fort Hill in Boston, and they were buying up these little houses and fixing them up. And the community he was living in started to be more important to him than singing Vododio-do or Razzmatazz songs. So he just decided to break it up, and it really got to, especially myself and Fritz. I sort of thought I was in a band that for my life. You know, I thought I had signed on for life. But it was the best thing that ever happened to me.
Why?
Because I knew very quickly that I had to learn the craft of music. In the jug band, everything was done, you know, yakking back and forth across a room laboriously for months on end, coming up with these unique arrangements, which I had a major part in. And I knew I couldn't just take that out in the world. So I started taking courses over at the Berklee School of Music, private lessons, and learning how to read and write. You know, it's been very helpful. That's why I get to do arrangements for people and write charts and write documentary film scores and things like that. So what looked like a disaster was just the next, you know, it was just one door closes, another one opens. And then all of a sudden Maria and my, you know, we're making albums with Amos Garrett and moving to Woodstock, and our manager Albert Grossman is getting us together with people. And then I'm with Paul Butterfield, and life just kept expanding.
Yeah, you and Maria Moldauer were married and performed together and did a couple of albums together. Do you want to do a song from that era of your life?
Yeah, I'd love to. This came out of the jug band, but it fit really nice with Amos Garrett and his beautiful electric guitar playing. This is called Gee Baby, Ain't I Good to You. Love makes me treat you the way that I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? Nothing's too good in this world for a girl like you. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? I bought your fur coat for Christmas. a diamond ring, a Cadillac car. Most everything is love makes me treat you the way that I do. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? And so it goes on like that.
Very nice. Gee, baby, ain't I good to you? Now, you left music for a few years. How long a hiatus was it?
It was about 17 years.
Whoa, that's really long. How come? I mean, you're so passionate about it and so good at it.
It's the classic crash and burn thing, you know, and I'm alive and some of my friends aren't. And I made a great effort to get out of the lifestyle I was in, and I've continued with that for the last 25 or 6 years. You know, after a while of working in, believe it or not, I was developing software for the steel industry in Detroit, Michigan, when Bob Neuwirth came to visit me, an old friend of mine, and he was in town recording Patti Smith. And he came up to my office, and I had programmers and analysts and a fancy suit on, and I was making money. And he wasn't impressed. He said, "Do you think anybody else can do this?" And I went, "Well, I guess so, Bob." He said, "You hear anybody out there playing music the way you play music?" "Well, I don't know. I guess not, Bob." It was one of those. And he dragged me over to Italy that fall. And that's when I got the bug again. I said, "You know what? I'm not knocking these Northern Italians silly, but I love this." And I started practicing. And that's when I came up with the Wild Ox Moan. And, you know, I got bit again. And I've been having the greatest time ever since.
Well, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like for you to perform some of the Wild Ox Moan. Maybe you can tell us about it before we hear it. The reason why I want you to do this, you go into this kind of like blues falsetto in it, which is almost like a blues yodel.
I do. But it's something that the writer of this tune, if she did write it, because it's so different, I almost can't believe anybody wrote it. Her name was Vera Hall, and she was a school teacher from outside of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And she recorded at the Library of Congress in the late 30s for the Lomaxes, I guess. And she had these little cracks she'd do in her voice. She did it with a few tunes, and she did The Bow Weevil, and she did children's songs. And I heard her when I was... She was one of those tunes that was, you know, on one of those jazz anthologies. You know, moo, 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 these little things like that. And I took to her. So I arranged what was an a cappella tune for the guitar and came up with this thing of the Wild Ox Moan. Well, run, hey, pretty woman, and sit on daddy's knee. I got something to tell you, woman. Well, don't you holler and please. Well, I'm going up the country. Well, don't you wanna go? Well, I'm going to Texas, 'cause that's where I belong. Well, that is where I belong.
Nice. Really good. Thank you so much for doing that. That's Wild Ox Moan. My guest is guitarist and singer and arranger Jeff Moldauer, and he has a new CD called Texas Sheiks. So do you feel that age and experience is like changing your taste at all in music, like not necessarily what you want to listen to, but what you want to perform or arrange?
It is getting that way. In other words, I do have plans to move away from the vocal because I'm a second tenor and you can't sing like this forever. Although I'm singing in the same keys I did when I was in the jug band when I was 19. So the same tunes and the same keys. So I'm very, very lucky. But it's a knock wood. And my chamber arrangements, I'm just as happy other people would sing some of the stuff I've put to chamber music, the Tennessee Williams poems, etc. So I'm planning in a more classical way. My model being Giuseppe Verdi, you know, because he didn't, you know, his greatest operas were written at the age of 70 plus, you know. So I got a lot of ideas and a lot of things I want to do. But digging down and shouting the blues, you can't do that forever.
Jeff Moldauer, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jeff Moldauer's new CD is called Texas Sheiks. Let's hear another track from it. This is Please Baby. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has assembled her annual list of holiday book buying recommendations. She calls it Suggestions for a Passionate Holiday, and she's definitely not talking about kissing Santa under the mistletoe. Here's her list.
It began to feel to me like an internet version of one of those parlor games, charades or statues, that people supposedly played at Victorian house parties during the holiday season. I had sent a few friends this email. I'm putting together a list of books that people have written about their passions. Can you help with some suggestions? The deluge began. The books I'm about to recommend, mostly slim volumes about places or things that the writers themselves deeply love, made the cut because either I came up with the suggestion myself or I heartily agreed after reading it. This was a big year for the pleasures of the palate, given the popularity of the film Julie and Julia. There are a trillion books on food out there, but if you've never read Lori Colwin, you must hunt up her two unpretentious essay collections called Home Cooking and More Home Cooking. Colwin died at 48 in 1993, and when I try to explain the power of her novels and short stories to people, I usually end up saying, her writing makes me happy, which sounds sappy, but it's true. I picked up her two books on cooking, definitely not my passion, because I had exhausted the rest of her writing. Here are Colwin's opening words in an essay on coffee. I come from a coffee-loving family, and you can always tell when my sister and I have been around because both of us collect all the dead coffee from everyone's morning cup, pour it over ice, and drink it. This is a disgusting habit. None of the pleasures Zadie Smith writes about in her terrific, just-published essay collection, Changing My Mind, fall into the disgusting category. They're more endearing, like her prose valentines to Zora Neale Hurston, Greta Garbo, and Katharine Hepburn. This collection also includes some poignant remembrances of David Foster Wallace and Smith's own father, a World War II vet who took part in the Normandy invasion. The great thing about Zadie Smith as a critic is that you get the sense here that her enthusiasms aren't fossilized yet, but are still being formed as she writes. Nonogenarian P.D. James has no doubt been passionate about lots of things in her long life, but to her worshipful readers, and I'm definitely in that multitude, it's her passion for investigating murder most foul that we really care about. In a new little work of criticism called Talking About Detective Fiction, James elegantly surveys the British and American mystery traditions, makes some educated guesses about the future of crime writing, and shares some of her long-tended enthusiasms for, among other writers, G.K. Chesterton. James, of course, lives in England, which would be my number one fantasy choice for where to spend the holidays. Not going to happen anytime soon, but armchair travel is cheap and profoundly pleasurable. I received lots of intriguing suggestions for good books about place, Pico Iyer on Japan, Ishmael Reed on Oakland, but the one recommendation I found irresistible was Mary McCarthy on Florence, because I find any occasion to read Mary McCarthy in all her tart brilliance irresistible. The book is called The Stones of Florence, and in it, McCarthy unveils what was then, in 1956, one of Italy's lesser tourist cities. She loves the handmade shoes, puts up with the then mediocre food, and winces at the sugary vision of the city crafted by Victorians like the Brownings. McCarthy also talks a lot about architecture, and one of the most revelatory appreciations of architecture I've come across is New Yorker critic Paul Goldberger's new book called Why Architecture Matters. This isn't a history of architecture, but rather something more elusive. Goldberger explains, everything has a feel to it, not just masterpieces, but everything in the built world. The purpose of this book is to come to grips with how things feel to us when we stand before them. Goldberger roams from classic masterpieces like the Pantheon to the architecture of memory, like the modest two-family house of his childhood in New Jersey. Any book about great architecture has to discuss the New York City skyline, and the minute I start thinking about New York, I think about E.B. White and his magnificent essay on the city called Here is New York. White wrote it in the summer of 1948 when he'd returned to the city from Maine for a weekend and began to remember how magical New York seemed to him as a young man. Here's the first sentence. On any person who desires such queer prizes, New York will bestow the gift of loneliness and the gift of privacy. On any reader who desires the prize of what I think is the essential essay about New York, E.B. White's Here is New York will bestow the gift of nostalgia tempered with an acceptance of the necessity of change, as well as the gift of an enduring passion.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can read a list of her suggestions and her complete review on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air.